Good morning and welcome to the Preventing Grace podcast for February 4th, 2019. There are dogs barking in the background. So last week we taped a great podcast.
It's been an hour long.
It was really great. Nice
we had
time.
A great podcast.
And then we didn't, in fact, put it on the internet because you didn't push play.
I pushed record. I didn't push record.
You didn't push record.
Right.
So that was great. We wasted an hour and a half of our lives.
Yeah, and it was a really good podcast. It was one of the best ones ever made.
Yeah, I think so.
If this one would have been published, it would have been.
We would have become famous.
People would have been asking us to write books and stuff.
Yeah. I think our banter was good.
Right.
Our subject matter, which I at this moment cannot remember.
We were talking about three tweets.
Oh, that's right. We had three tweets. It was the three tweet podcast.
Yeah. About the blindfold church service.
Yeah.
But, oh well.
They're old now, so we can't talk about them. Instead, we have a real question from our listener that we're going to talk about. And I think that you had some things you wanted to say about the Super Bowl.
Did I? Oh. I don't think I wanted to say anything.
Oh.
I think you made that up. I read some funny articles about the halftime show.
Oh.
And I sent them to you. But I didn't want to talk about the Super Bowl because I'm so angry that the Patriots won. I'm so mad. I can't stand the Patriots. I want them to lose. When I was a kid in the 80s, they were horrible. They were awful. I loved it when the Cowboys would play the Patriots because it means they're gonna win, so you had a great weekend, but now they're this horrible, horrible organization that deserves to be crushed. But the Rams, you know, they should have had another team in there against the Patriots.
They should have just let you pick the team.
I think the Saints could have actually beat the Patriots.
But you don't like the Saints.
I don't like the Saints either, but any team against the Patriots becomes, you know, America's team, the right team to win. I didn't like the Eagles either, but they beat the Patriots, so I'm really happy. I was happy last year, I mean. This year, I was so sad. It was so sorrowful.
So is our year over?
No, it's just going to be depressing. It's worse. It's bad, too, because we live close to New England, so there's lots of people up here who like the Patriots, and it's...
Yeah. It feels wrong.
It does. It is wrong. It's morally wrong.
It feels morally wrong. So, I didn't watch the game at all, nor any of the commercials, because I was sitting talking to people who also didn't care about the game.
I thought the commercials were really bad this year, too. They weren't funny. They weren't... I remember a long time ago, they used to be genuinely funny, and now they've become really not funny.
Like, get off my lawn. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
I just watched one commercial that somebody said was the funniest commercial of the night.
Which one? The one with the cowboy, the football players.
They're in a fancy dinner with beautiful, beautiful tables. And then they begin to throw a football around and they destroy the room. And I don't see what's great about that. It seems like apocalyptically bad and terrible. Like that. That made everybody happy on the internet. That is also morally wrong. If you have big, big, beautiful mounds of roses and a gorgeous cake, and then you take a football and throw it around the room until everything is destroyed, that's not good. That's not funny. That's evil.
Yeah.
Of course, I don't know who any of the people in the room were throwing the football, so...
They were ex-football players. Former football players who are gathering for a dinner or something like that, and so they decided to.
And that's what they do. Somebody gives them a nice dinner, and they destroy everything. and nobody's upset with them.
It must be. I'm not sure. I don't even know what the premise. And this is another thing. I don't even know what the commercial is for. You know what the commercial is for?
Uh-oh.
You just saw it. You don't know what it's for.
I have no idea. No idea what it's for. So, well, that was bad. I had a nice evening with my friends, talking about things that had nothing to do with football at all.
It's so strange that you do that.
Except the children were in a room shouting, just shrieking so loudly that I came away with a pounding headache because of just the volume of like seven teenage boys shouting. I don't even know if any of them knew what was going on with the football, but they were shouting as if they were actually watching the game. It was a trial. Get off my lawn is what I'm saying. All y'all, get off my lawn.
Yeah, there are too many teenagers in our church.
Yeah, I think that's true.
They're all lumbering. They're big. Yeah. They're large, and they're banging around and with their teenagers. They're loud,
they're everywhere.
They should just, what should we do with them?
Put them in.
Including our children.
Put them in a corner somewhere. Just sit quiet.
Yeah, who would like that? I used to think when I was a younger minister that
we really wanted teenagers.
We need teenagers in it. No, we don't.
Yeah.
They need...
And they careen around, bashing into nice little old ladies like me. And then you can see people sort of tense up when they come in their huge pack, shouting and...
They are very good teenagers.
I mean, they're probably nice people.
Yeah.
But something ought to be done.
I was reading a book that Vikings... And maybe I'm about to launch out here into something I'm not quite sure I remember correctly, but
good.
But that when a boy became a teenager, they would have to go live by themselves in this kind of fire hut, and they couldn't be around other people until they became like 20 or so.
That's a good
idea. Or 15 or so or whatever. Until they were married off, but they just had to live in this hut by themselves apart from the village. Which makes perfect sense. I mean, that's the best place for a teenage boy when...
I mean, that's...
I can't verify the historicity of that
actual...
Right.
It's possible that you just made that up.
I have a vague memory of reading it somewhere, but... in a book about Vikings.
Well,
which I can't remember.
I think that's what they used to do with women in the Bible, is send them away.
Oh, and there was that village. Oh, we shouldn't talk about this, though, should we? There's that village in, was it India? Is it in India? Or is it in the Himalayas?
Nepal.
Where when it's that time of the month, women go Shark off week. By themselves, right? And they have this little village. Yeah.
That,
which I think is a great idea,
I also think that's a great idea.
That's a perfect idea.
There's nothing wrong with that. That sounds like they go away quietly by themselves and rest. And then they come home. And everybody's happy and fine. It seemed like the most sane thing that I had ever heard of, ever. We don't have enough social isolation. I think that's what we're saying.
So we should have the teenage boy village and the women village for that when their aunt comes to visit or whatever.
The temporary, temporary women's village and the man's village. Maybe we should stop and talk about our listener question.
Right.
Since we're treading on.
Can I say something about my Twitter conversation I've just been having?
Okay.
I'm irritated. I'm so mad. I'm not mad. I'm frustrated.
Okay.
Because if...
Why don't you provide some background?
Okay.
I didn't realize you were having a conversation on Twitter.
So, a Roman Catholic person...
Are you gonna,
who I don't know...
Are you going to be offensive right now? Is that what's...
No, I'm not going to be offensive. I'm going to be calm, mm-hmm. and I'm going to explain...
You're going to Anglican explain?
Yes. Yeah. So apparently, no one has any idea what the Bible is until the church came along and told us what the Bible would be. Because without the church, we wouldn't know what the canon is. We wouldn't know that there even is a Bible. So Jesus did not give us the Bible. It was the original tweet. Jesus gave us the church, and the church gave us the Bible.
Okay.
So can you spot the flaw in the reasoning there?
I mean... Probably. It's really early in the morning, though, so why don't you go ahead and enlighten me? What do you dislike about that? I mean, first of all,
well,
it's not
okay,
true.
So when Jesus says to his opponents, have you not read?
I thought that Jesus...
Referring to the scriptures, or when Jesus says to them in Mark chapter 7, you are elevating your traditions over the scriptures. He rebukes them for that. They could have just said, well, what are you talking about? We don't have... There are no scriptures yet. There won't be scriptures until the magisterium comes along. And even then, you know, the magisterium of the church isn't going to pronounce what the canon is in a De Fide way until the 15th century when the Council of Florence comes along. So, hey, there is no Bible. And then all those centuries before the church made a definitive declaration, that's 15 centuries, anybody referring to the Bible was just, what are they talking about? No one has any possible way of knowing what the Bible is until the church comes along and tells us. It's absurd. I'm sorry. I think Roman Catholics need to construct a better argument for the case they try to make about the canon, because it doesn't work. We say that the Bible is composed of those books that the apostles oversaw the writing of or gave, and that's based on the promise to them in John chapter 16 verses 12 through 15, and in John chapter 14 verses 25, and
well, the writers of the New Testament clearly think that they're writing scripture.
Yeah.
Paul's writing scripture. Their tone is such that they think that they're being authoritative.
Yeah.
In their writing, and Jesus himself seems to be speaking, yes, as it were, with authority.
Yes, because he's, you know, God, and the apostles know they're speaking with his words when they speak and they write. So it's just,
well, why is it important for you to?
Because someone's wrong.
Correct the internet.
And this guy is just, and I didn't know, but Luther removed James and Hebrews from the Bible. Did you know that?
I didn't know that.
No idea, but it turns out he had that kind of authority.
He didn't really like James.
Yeah, he did critique it, but I didn't know he actually removed it. So if we would go back to Luther's translation of the Bible, which he made,
we wouldn't be finding
Hebrews or or James, no, apparently.
Wrong. Maybe you should do some more reading of books and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So,
you just wanted to clarify on our podcast that person
yes,
is wrong?
Yes, that person is wrong. It's okay. It, just for everyone to know.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
Is this going to occupy your whole
day?
Yeah,
my mind is occupied because I'm, this is something people, I don't know where the, I don't understand why people run to the Roman Catholic Church for authority, because there's so many different ways of understanding the Bible. We need to have this authoritative magisterial teaching to tell us what the Bible means. And then you're left with two problems. One is that
who's
interpreting the magisterium? And then secondly, that makes the church irreformable. If the church alone can infallibly interpret the Bible, the Bible no longer can correct the church. You necessarily will go to every text with an eisegetical way of looking at it, because you cannot come out of the Bible with any reading contrary to what the church has already said. And that makes the church, instead of sola scriptura, you do sola ecclesia, where the church becomes its own umpire. And that's exactly what Jesus and the apostles did not want to happen. You test all things in light of the word, not in light of, you know, the magisterium, because the magisterium is dependent, or the teaching office of the church is dependent on the scriptures, not the other way around.
Well, I think it's, I mean, there's a question of whether you can, I think this is a broader cultural question too, whether or not you can understand what it is that you're reading. The activity of reading, is that something that the human person looking at words on a page, can the human person understand them, or is that such a strange and difficult activity that you have to add in layers of things?
Right.
And this goes to books, like, not just the Bible, but can you understand the book that you're reading?
Even with the teacher.
Or do you need somebody to come and read it for you?
But, you know, this is another place where there's this kind of false dichotomy that's drawn, because a Roman Catholic apologist will say, well, you know, you either have the inerrant, infallible magisterium giving you doctrine and interpretation of the text, or it's everyone with their Bible under the tree. Me and my Bible under the tree. When no, I mean the teaching office of the church is nothing that the Protestant the Reformed people have ever rejected. It's crucial. You have to have teachers. You have to have people to help. You have to have a church there, helping people to understand the scriptures. But the question is, does that church need to be infallible in order to do that? And no, it doesn't. Any more than you need to have an infallible English teacher to help you understand Moby Dick. It's you can have a fallible English teacher who knows Moby Dick better than you do.
Reading.
Right. Who can help you come to a better understanding of Moby Dick. You don't need an infallible administration over that teacher, making sure that teacher pronounces the infallible interpretation of Moby Dick, because Moby Dick is a book that you can read and understand. And yeah. So is the Bible.
I agree with you.
I know.
It's hard for us to have this conversation because I'm not your opponent. Your opponent is on Twitter.
I know.
So.
And you know what he's doing right now when we're talking? He's tweeting away. He's replying to my tweets. And I need to get on there and tell him he's wrong again.
Oh, man. This is the downfall of Western civilization.
See, this is what Paul would be doing, though. He'd be on Twitter.
I did. Okay. I woke up in the middle of the night, and I wondered to myself, because I wake up in the middle of every night. Sometimes I pray. Sometimes I read Twitter. Sometimes I lie there and curse the darkness. But at 2 a.m. of this night, I wondered to myself, what would Jesus tweet? And what would Paul tweet? And I'm pretty sure that Paul would be knocked off of Twitter within like a few minutes of being on Twitter. Like, can you imagine Paul on Twitter responding to people?
Yeah.
Why are you nodding at me like that? What do you think Paul would tweet?
I think he would go after this guy. I think he would go after this guy with hammer and tongs.
This is more important. This is what I was wandering around. But you have to stop looking at your phone while I'm talking to you.
I'm hearing you.
No, you're reading somebody else's comment while I'm...
I'm listening to you.
And you're commenting on some other thread. So, there was a piece a while ago, I think it was Carol Pryor, about etiquette for Twitter. Like, how ought the Christian conduct himself or herself on Twitter for the glory of God?
And what did she say?
I can't remember. There were like 7 things, and they were basically like, try to be an embodied person, be kind, don't commit slander, respond to the substance of tweets rather than like what you don't make straw men. I'm pretty sure it was stuff like that. You have to stop tweeting while I'm doing this.
Sorry.
So, yes. But then on Twitter, somebody else who I follow, I can't remember who, read that article and said, this is a pretty good article, but I disagree about being an embodied person on Twitter. You should actually, everybody should be allowed to have a pseudonym. Everybody should tweet anonymously.
I agree with that. I like that.
Because then...
I mean, I see why people think it's cowardly to do that. Because people who do tweet anonymously sometimes just have... They do it because they want to say some horrible things.
Right. Slanderously horrible things without any repercussions.
Right.
But the problem with trying to be an embodied person on Twitter is that you cannot be an embodied person on Twitter. You cannot be a fully formed human person. It's by nature... the platform requires that you are only engaging at one level, and that if you're going to really have ideas going back and forth without the junk of, unkindness and personal emotion, you should all have pseudonyms that keep you from building platform in the first place around your own personality or your own self-constructed personality. And I think that's a fascinating idea. I think it would be great because nobody would even know who you were. You'd have to engage in the realm of ideas rather than with your person, your constructed personhood.
Yeah. I agree. I think it's good.
This is the worst podcast ever. Okay. Well, let's answer our listener question.
I'm sorry. I was not in the mood to podcast when we started. Huh? I was not podcasting. I was in responding to Twitter mood when we got on the podcast. So I'm sorry. I will be better now. So
okay. Let's try to have a conversation, because that's what we're all about, is just kindness and conversation.
Okay.
I swear, if you look at your phone one more time, I'm gonna have like a... Okay. So someone, an Anglican, wrote us, our Anglican listener, and this person goes to a church with more than one campus. So I didn't know that that was possible in the Anglican world, because I thought that was kind of a mega church thing. Like, if you go to Matt Chandler's church, you pick from one of the many campuses and you see Matt Chandler's face on the screen, and then there's a campus pastor, but everything that you do kind of is an outflow of the original campus. We know people who do that. We know somebody who goes to something called the Liquid Church.
Right, right.
Which is a multi-campus
thing.
Which I think is strangely like having a bishop.
Yeah,
because you isn't your teaching pastor really the bishop?
Right.
And everybody else is his sort of...
Yeah.
It's a strange reversion to early church times, maybe, but in a
weird way. All went to go to the, you know, the bishop
would like say, well, this is my person here and that's my person, and he would check off on him, right, or whatever. Okay, so this, but in the Anglican world, I'm pretty sure, based on a tiny bit of research that I did, which is almost none, that there's no beaming in of the person. The pastor, each campus has a person who teaches and preaches at that campus. They're not having somebody come in on a Megatron. So the church, each campus would have its own teaching and its own preaching.
Okay.
But what is shared are administrative issues, costs, and vestry. So there might be one vestry with four or five different churches under it. That to me seems
okay.
I mean, I can see that being interesting and strange.
Right, I can see that being a helpful way of keeping costs down for small plants.
Right.
Yeah.
So my question is, I don't know the answer to this. Would those small satellite campuses ever? Would the goal ever be for them to be on their own, or is the model that they always remain tied to the main parent church? I don't know the answer to this.
That question.
But it seems like maybe not, because in this,
maybe not what?
In this question, like, the goal is never for them to be on their own. This church was planted more than a decade ago.
And
it started as a new church, but instead of being a true church plant, it became a second campus and a multi-site model. A single staff is shared between both sites. There are no designated staff for both parishes. The way things happen, though, every one of the five clergy staff families worships at the other location, and the clergy and staff have to work... They come to work at the second site, but they don't bring their families with them. So it sounds like supply.
Mm.
Like, everybody's at the main site, and then supply are sent over to the second site. The two campuses were supposed to focus on their respective neighborhoods, but because one meets in the morning, it became, by default, the family service with 75% of the church's kids. And the second site met in the late afternoon, and it has a core of dedicated families. But the other service is really focused on kids. So, here's the question. The pastors are no longer very relationally connected at the second campus. It's like pulpit supply. The person who comes and preaches doesn't really know the people in the congregation. And pastoral care needs are going unmet because the pastors are not fully aware. They are all their families are at the main campus, and so they don't have relational ties. They now want to get rid of all children's programming at the second campus.
Oh.
When the second campus raised a hue and cry, the leadership was shocked and surprised. And that's because they didn't really know the second campus. So, there's no issues of doctrine. The preaching is good.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships are good. But what should they do?
Okay, so I think part of the problem is a misunderstanding of what preaching is. Right? It's not... It's you going on to some website and watching a pastor preach, for example, is you're going to get some good doctrine probably from that. You're going to get some good Bible teaching from that. But preaching is also an interaction with the congregation. What makes preaching something that God uses to change hearts is because the preacher knows his people, and he's applying a text to a people that he knows. And that doesn't happen if you have someone kind of dropping in who doesn't know your congregation. It doesn't happen if you have just a series of guest speakers every Sunday. You're never gonna have that interaction and engagement that you should be having with a given body.
So preaching is not a consumption of the Word of God, like in the way that you would go out and buy new couch cushions. Right? Like
you find the right whatever looks good to you, yeah, and you buy it,
and so you're redoing your living room, you go to Target, you buy all your new stuff for the season, you come in and then you're pretty satisfied and you're comfortable in your new living room with all your couch cushions. I think that's how people think of preaching, though, because you find the preaching that suits you,
right?
And that's how most evangelicals think of preaching. So you can get it anywhere. If you go to a church and you don't like the preaching, well, once you go home in the afternoon, you can listen to Matt Chandler, and then you are quote fed,
right?
And as long as you're being fed, you're fine,
right?
But actually, that's not what preaching is for.
Well, it is partly, but the intention of the New Testament is that you are being fed by preaching in the context of a congregation, with your brothers and sisters who are also being fed. There's a different element of correction, nourishment, rebuke, all those things that the Bible's supposed to do. There's a different element when it's in a corporate body than it is when you're by yourself or when you're alone. And I think actually taking a pastor who's not in that congregation and putting him in there is a little bit like listening to a sermon on your own, because he's not preaching to anybody. He's preaching or to that group. He's preaching in a general sort of way, which again, it's not if you want to do that. I mean, I listen to sermons all the time from people who I don't know and don't know me, and I think it's a great thing to do. But as your weekly Sabbath feeding, it doesn't suffice for the long term.
It's a little bit like, I've listened to, since we've done so much Catholic bashing already today, when you have like seven different masses available to you,
mm-hmm.
And you just have to clock in at mass. You know, you go in the evening, you clock in.
Yeah.
The pastor says four things that he thought of about the text, and Episcopalians do this too, and then you clock back out, and you go home and you got what it was that you came for, and so you're good to go.
Right.
Like the preaching should be a tense wrestling between the pastor, the congregation, and the Word of God. And so the three just have to sort of uncomfortably wrestle together and become, first of all, the whole body, because the church is formed and shaped by the preaching of the church. The pastor is formed and shaped by the congregation as he preaches to them. He changes. And then the word, as they grapple with it together, gives them a new kind of characteristic. It's not an individual consuming of something. It's the whole body gathered together that gives you your own character, your own flavor as a body.
So in John chapter 6, if I were preaching this, that text in, which we just got finished with John 6, if I were preaching that in San Antonio, Texas, to a suburban wealthy congregation, and I'd been in there for a long time, my preaching would be a lot different to them than it would be to the less than wealthy congregation at Good Shepherd. It's the culture is so different. Now the exegesis of the passage would be the same, but how you craft the sermon, how you put it together, the points you make, the application points you make are going to be so widely different. And that's because you have to know the people you're preaching to for a sermon really to hit home in a consistent way. Not that I do it all the time, just saying that's the model.
It's one reason why you shouldn't just, like a lot of Anglicans, Episcopalians, you preach through the lectionary one time, you have 9 years worth of sermons, you're good. First, you can move. You can go to a different church now.
And just take the
take your 9 years of sermons.
Take your sermon out of your file.
And just do it again. And then you can go somewhere else 9 years later, and you can just do that.
Right.
Because you have your 9 years worth of sermons.
Right.
It's a very different activity to take a book of the Bible and then preach that with the congregation, because the congregation becomes a different and a changed place as you work through that.
Right.
But also, I mean, it's not, I think the multi-site thing is a curiosity to me, because it is hard. There are a lot of small struggling churches around here. Like, administratively, we have to keep our building going. The vestry has to meet once a month, which is a burden on the people who come and deal with the questions of money, when they all have real jobs and they have things that they'd probably rather be doing.
Yeah.
And if we were to plant another church around here, I can see how we would be able to really help that smaller congregation by giving them
administration.
Our secretary could do all their work, or we do it all mm-hmm. one time, and mm-hmm. then they would just live off the outflow of everything mm-hmm. that we've mm-hmm. done. On the other hand, it's true, they would always just be sort of a strange appendage. Well, they wouldn't become their
I think there's a way to do it, that you make sure the pastor is in residence. Whoever's leading that branch off is in residence there. Doesn't come to Good Shepherd, doesn't come to the bigger church. Only comes to that church, and that way it could work, because you would need administrative help and financial support for a church plant like that.
You could pay the person what they were worth being paid,
right?
And they wouldn't have to starve to death,
right?
That's true. But I mean, what's the goal of that? Does it go on like that for generations, or?
Yeah, I think the ultimate goal would be
the ultimate goal would be that you would want them to, have their own vestry.
Yeah.
Have a local body that's making
decisions
for them.
Right.
And they're not sort of beholden to somebody who doesn't know them.
It's very colonial.
it is colonial.
That's
true.
Establish this.
I also find that it's a weird thing of trust.
New Good Shepherd off on the other side of Binghamton, which is exactly like us, but we rule it.
We rule it.
And they don't have any say in their own ruling.
We will tax them.
We will. They will tie it to us. This is very colonial. It's very. I can see why Anglicans might be interested in it.
Because it worked so well for the empire.
Right, right.
And there were no repercussions later on.
Right.
Everything is great now around the old British Empire.
Right.
Everyone's happy and fine. I feel like it's a trust issue. Like, what do you trust? Where is your hope? What do you trust? Does the parent church trust the smaller church to And do you trust your ability to be fed? Like, do you trust the pastor that you have to feed you? So when you go to a church where the pastor is beamed in on the Megatron, he's saying to all of his understaff, I don't trust any of you to exegete God's word or to talk to any of these people. I don't believe that you can pastor these people. You're not good enough. I'm the only one that can do this job.
Yeah.
And I don't think that's probably true. Like, I think there's a dire emergency of bad preaching in America. In every denomination, there's just a crisis of bad preaching. But one way to remedy that is to have people beamed in on a Megatron. Or you could teach people to preach better. But that's harder, and that takes longer. And it requires that you trust ordinary guys with the souls of ordinary people. Mm-hmm. And it's not special, it's not flashy.
Right.
You're not vision casting, you're just showing up to the pulpit every week trying to work your way out of the paper bag of the scriptures, which most people can't do.
Yeah.
Better to teach everyone how to preach than to have more and more screens.
No, I think that's right. And that's what, you know, I think identifying young men who are able to do it and then training them and sending them off to seminary I won't say it's more important, but it's on the level of church planting as far as importance goes for the proclamation or the expansion of the faith.
I would say that here's the tension between church planting and so, because of course as a small denomination we want there to be lots of churches. We want to be able to say, look how many churches we have in that place. If you had fewer churches though and you had better preachers, so supposing you didn't plant that church right now, you had people go to the bigger church where the preacher was good. And you took the time, and it was longer, mm-hmm. and it was less flashy. You took the time to train the next preacher mm-hmm. all the way, and then you were able to financially support him mm-hmm. when he planted his church.
Yeah.
And then he really invested where he was. I mean, that would be what I would want to do.
Yeah.
But
I was reading an article this morning. I think I sent it to you. It was a strange article, but it was comparing the millennial lack of golf playing. Like, golf takes about 6 hours if you're going to do it. And, you know, kind of a real investment of time and of concentration. And just
no one wants to do that.
So little tiny neighborhood golf clubs are slowly dying because no one wants to belong to them anymore. Whereas they used to be booming, right? People, that would be what men did on the weekends. They would go play golf and no more. And the person was comparing that to the decline of the small neighborhood church,
mm-hmm.
and saying, well, it's so much easier to go to a big box church where no one has to know you, and you get the packaged preaching that you want. Maybe it's good preaching. I mean, let's say you go to John MacArthur's church, which is huge. It's good preaching, right? But
he doesn't know you.
He doesn't know you, right? And then so there's this. And so, but it's so it's easier to go to a bigger church like that because you do get some anonymity and less requirements of investing of your time and your
so it suits them. It suits them.
Right.
And it suits you.
Right. Right. So the small churches, which require the same kind of commitment that a golf game might require, which is you get in there, you get to know people, you serve, you do all the work that a normal small church requires, people don't want that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're having these smaller churches die, but then the article is saying, well, the bigger churches should look at the death of these smaller churches as the canary in the...
Yeah.
Because once people... Once the body of the people decide commitment to a church is not something they have time for, don't think your big church is going to last very long. It's you now just filling your pews with people who are not looking for commitment, not looking for for actual real discipleship in any kind of way. And it's going to be just a matter of time before
you go bust. Then you have to have more and more light shows, and you've got to have on the massive, I don't know, I saw another thing for Super Bowl Sunday. They were having church. They had dinosaurs and football on this stage, and nothing about it resembled church. Like, because it's Super Bowl Sunday.
We reviewed the dinosaur.
No, this was like a new...
Oh, a new dinosaur?
There's more dinosaurs. Oh. This is what I wanted to complain about. A really good evangelical whom I follow on Twitter, whose name I can't remember, said, well, this is why we need the regulative principle. I was like, no, that doesn't help you. Like...
Oh, because to get rid of the dinosaurs,
yeah.
Right? Well, okay.
That's the way we get rid of the dinosaurs.
There is tension in the normative principle, like, because I think some people read the normative principle, and if you don't know what the normative principle is, the normative principle says the church is free to worship in a way, in the way the church feels is most effective or whatever, feels is most faithful, so long as it doesn't contradict the scriptures. And there is a problem there, right? Because you could read that as, oh,
I can have dinosaurs.
Anything goes, right? Let's pull out the liturgical dancers and the dinosaurs. And that's not, of course, what the normative principle is, but that's how it sometimes is read. The regular principle, by contrast, though.
You can only do what's in the Bible.
Right.
And I'm sorry, but the person who tweeted that, there's no way that their worship looks anything like it would have looked in the Bible.
Right.
He should come to an Anglican church because it probably looks more like it would have than his thing. He probably has a bare stage, a bare pulpit. He's wearing a suit, which, I'm sorry, that's not there. That's not what Jesus wore. Take it to both extremes, and I think you can find
I'm amused when I hear, what's all this liturgy?
Do you have a guitar?
This liturgy stuff isn't in the Bible anywhere. You're adding some. No, I mean, when Jesus goes to synagogue, as was his custom,
and unrolls the
in Luke chapter 4. What's he doing? Well, he's participating in a liturgical service. Those synagogue services in the first century were liturgical. They had set, recited prayers that people memorized. They had recited, they recited psalms. They had two readings of the law and then the prophets. And then they had preaching afterwards. It was very liturgical. The only thing the Christian church did is add the Eucharist to the end of the synagogue service.
Which looks a little bit like the liturgy of the Passover.
Right.
Which Jesus also himself engaged in.
So you had liturgy of the word and liturgy of the sacrament going right back to the first century. And Jesus participated in the liturgy of the word. And then after he descended into heaven, he instituted the liturgy of the sacrament. So
if you're looking for the normative, why you want the normative principle, you should go, maybe I'll link it, but I played it. I never do this in Sunday school. I never play any media things in my Sunday school because we don't do that. But I did get my little iPad up because we did the presentation or the Song of Simeon in my Sunday school class.
Okay.
And I played that old clip of the Bible. An airplane lands and boxes of Bibles are unloaded. It's like Papua New Guinea or something, or Indonesia. And the man who I think it's the pastor, prays the prayer of Simeon as he's receiving these boxes of Bible, and he's of the Bible, and he says, just as Simeon held the Lord Christ in his arms, I am finally holding the word.
Wow.
And my eyes have finally seen my salvation.
That's
and
me.
I can die now. And he prays the prayer in a culture. They're all dressed up with feathers and spears, and they're singing a locally appropriate song that they themselves wrote.
That's the purpose of the normative principle.
That's the purpose.
Right.
And you wouldn't want to come in because...
Where are the organs?
Yeah.
Why don't you need electric guitars? Right.
And they said, well, you can't have your balafon, your drum, because your feathers, because that's not in the Bible. Meanwhile, the missionary is not wearing phylacteries. Like, go put on the single robe that Jesus wore and then come back out of your patent leather shoes and tell other people what they're... I'm shouting.
You're almost as mad as I am about
this. I know. I'm suddenly so angry. I would say, I'm sure we should stop this because Charlie Brown is now being played on the piano downstairs.
I think we've systematically offended All of our listener.
I don't have any advice about what to do about the multi-campus thing because, or what. I wouldn't want to say somebody leave your church, like, but yeah. In general, I'm not inclined to encourage people to leave their churches unless there's like blatant heresy or abuse. But I think it is worth to struggle and like go and complain and ask to go to vestry meetings and just throw a big stink, because if you're unhappy, this is what happens to us. People are unhappy, quietly unhappy, and they don't say anything until it's too late. And then and then they're like, "Oh, well, I'm leaving now." No, if the minute you feel like something is out of balance or not good or they're going in the wrong way, go to your pastor and your vestry
and talk about it.
And bring it up and give them a chance to
do something.
Do something, cuz I think most pastors, most vestries, most elder boards
want to keep their people.
Want to keep their people and will do whatever they can do within reason to address concerns and anxieties and so don't just sit there and like we've had people on our vestry who are like, "Well, I just don't know what they're doing." I'm like,
"Who's they?
Who's they?
You
are they.
Are part of the vestry."
Don't sit back. And judge what everybody else is doing. Go, because they people, we're all blind. We all sort of get into what's easiest. You know, we get into patterns. We just go on with our ministries without, you know, we're tired. Everybody's tired. And you don't want to disrupt, but it's better. It's better to bring it to
the body. I mean, just this last week, we had someone bring something up to us, which we had thought of making this change. We had some objections to it, and they were legitimate, and there were things we could change, so we did. We went back on what we were going to do, and that's. But on the other hand, you know, I had a couple who left the church was upset with me that I wasn't holding out the possibility that sin is just a bad habit. That now that we're Christians,
we can be.
We don't have to sin.
Right.
It's all. We can be purely. Holy sanctified, and
so every time you talked about sin, they were mad at you, and they didn't say anything. But even when they did, they were never going to be happy,
right?
Like, and that wasn't something
they didn't
come
to me saying, "Hey, can you help us understand what you're teaching?" They came to me saying, "Let me teach you how to think about sin as a Christian."
Right.
That is, you don't have to do it.
And then that turned out not to be true.
Right.
And if you preached that would have been.
So they left, which is. Understandable.
Tragic.
Well, it's tragic, but I mean, you know, that's, we can't do anything to stop that.
Right.
But there are things we can do to stop.
There's a lot of things that we can do to, I mean, just like marriage, and people who say that church isn't like marriage are absolutely wrong, because you're not married to all the people in the church.
Yeah.
You're married to your spouse. You're only married to one person, but the body together is supposed to be married to Christ. And so the contention that you bring to your marriage, which you should bring, a contending where you struggle. You're not at peace with each other all the time. You are struggling for peace.
Right.
You're struggling to be of a common mind and a common way of thinking together and a common life that you work out day by day. And it's difficult. You don't just back off into your corner and let the other person do whatever they want.
Right.
Like, if you've done that in your marriage, you're on a bat. You need to bring your contention all the time, day by day. The same way with the church. You have to contend for the church, in the church, which means you struggle with other individual people. You struggle with the body itself. You struggle with the preaching. You struggle.
Yeah.
And you don't just back off just for the sake of, because you're tired. You bring it. And I would say, if you're in a big church where you can't do that, then
it's
you're not being known. And
You're
not, your pastor can't preach to you.
Right.
And that's,
again, not saying leave your big church, but there's, you know, even big churches have figured out strategies to alleviate that by
some
having
home
smaller
groups. Yeah.
Yeah, home group. Yeah,
make
sure
there's people that you are in combat with, in charitable, loving, good intent, proper intention combat.
Yeah.
Spiritual wrestling. And then you don't let go of those people. Like, take the picture of Jacob wrestling with the angel, and you don't let go. You say, I'm not. I don't care. I'm not letting go.
Right.
Unless you turn out to be a total heretic.
Right. Yeah, it's you know, we had the annual meeting yesterday, and it was crazy.
Yeah.
It was just insane. I feel like
all the crazy came to Good Shepherd yesterday.
One of our parishioners tweeted or posted on Facebook, ah, the Good Shepherd annual meeting. A weird mix of excitement, joy, and trepidation at the idea that anyone can stand up and say any old thing that comes into their head. And yes.
Boy, that happens.
Yes, that happens. But it was interesting because, you know, that's the church. It's the strange body of Christ being...
It's made up of people who are right on the edge.
Right.
And of functioning, of spiritual functioning, of mental abilities. I mean, we have some people at our church who... we have some homeless people who are not all there emotionally mm-hmm. and psychologically yep. and are just having huge issues, and they are allowed to walk into our parish hall and greet the visitors of
which
the
they
day.
Do, which they do.
They do.
I don't know why we're not growing.
I don't know. We are growing.
We are growing.
But
it's funny.
But that's not, like, the reason for that is that if you think in your functioning that you're really functioning, you're really not. Like, you may be a few tiers up the ladder away from our homeless community. Like, you've got your clothes on, no problem. Yeah. And you know how to take an ibuprofen when your sinuses hurt really, really bad. And you don't have to, like, you know, argue angrily with the person who says, maybe I could help you with your sinuses. You're more functional than that, but you're going to take your turn as the crazy person in the church. You will take your turn. And you need to just accept that and accept the love and compassion of people who have also taken their turn
right.
as the resident crazy.
Right. So we posted recently that, you know, when you look at the writings of the apostles and what Jesus says, it's... He never commends anyone for being intelligent.
That's true.
There's no biblical...
mandate?
Yeah, well, say wow. Or even, like, the apostles or Jesus stepping back and saying, wow, you're really smart.
That's true. Even, in John 6, Peter says these beautiful words, to whom shall we go? And Jesus is like, well, whatever.
I called you. That's why you're saying that.
And you're... good luck. One of you is the devil.
Right. Right.
Like, you want a big hug right then. Like, right. Oh.
That's so wonderful.
This is a moment.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah. Thank you for not leaving me.
And even the other, where Peter confesses Christ. In Matthew chapter 16, I think Jesus says, yep, flesh and blood didn't give you those.
Yeah.
That's not from you.
You're not.
You were not able to say that by yourself, Peter.
You're not that smart.
Right.
In fact, right. you're... If we're looking for smarts, none of you.
Well, you can see why. I mean, it probably never occurs to Jesus to compliment
human beings on their intelligence. That's true. It's like when the angel is surprised that they're all... When the angel is he surprised when they're all staring up at heaven? Like, what are you guys doing
here? What are you doing?
It's probably Jesus every time somebody speaks.
Right. I would have loved... I don't know if I would have loved to see it, because it probably would have burned and... I would have been undone. But when Zechariah says, well, how do I know this is going to happen?
Yeah. There is this, like, what? I don't understand.
I wonder if angels blink or what? Are you shaking his head. I stand in God's presence.
I know. Like I just said.
Here, I'm what shining more do you in want? Blinding glory.
What more do you glory. Want, man? And Zechariah's like, what? I don't get it. All of John 6 was like that.
Yeah.
It's just one big long misunderstanding between God and humanity. Yeah.
So, anyway.
Well, I can tell that this is going to be a great day. And I don't know, did we sin or did our parents sin that we did like a great podcast
and it went away?
disappeared.
Yeah, this is like a subpar.
This is a podcast bad,
compared
bad
to what podcast. We did last week.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is lost forever. It's like the lost Beatles album or something. It's like the letter that Paul wrote to Laodicea and no one can find.
And nobody can find it.
Right.
That's what this.
But it's probably the best one of all the letters.
Whereas which one is this? is this like Corinthians?
This is. Well, I like Corinthians.
Oh, you do? Yeah. Okay.
It all depends on what we like too.
Yeah.
So, all right. You should close off or something, okay, since it's your podcast.
We'll be back next week, probably, unless somebody is offended.